So let me just check one thing. Okay, right, we're off. Who's going to talk first?
Hi, I'm Roger Cheatham, and having quite a surreal experience at the moment of finding myself not being a morning person, having had 13 and a half years of pub landlord. I'm very much the night owl rather than the morning lark. So having discovered this morning that there is more than 1 6 o'clock in a day, and already having attended a networking event at Destination Depot in Sheffield this morning, I now find myself in the back of the Zulan. Is that the right?
Zulon.
Zulon, I beg your pardon.
That's good. That's
what's a vowel between friends? In the Zulon van, having a general conversation with Martin Spence and Chris Sissons.
Yes, and I'm here listening to Roger and Martin. I'm Chris Sissons, and I've also been at Destination Depot this morning. And my background is in community development, but now I am a marketing coach. So how do you go from community development to marketing? You may or may not find out in this conversation.
Okay. So we've met each other a few times now at these various networking events and so on. I find them useful, not necessarily for business. It's more of a social occasion, but I think as time goes on, I'm beginning to understand how these networking things kind of work. There's an awful lot of them. I personally only do a couple in terms of time and everything else. In terms of, you're Sheffield based, is that right, Roger?
Just over the border in Rotherham, so I still need my passport to come over to Sheffield, but Yorkshireman through and through.
Yes, well, that is interesting. Whereabouts were you born?
I was born in Rotherham.
Oh, right. So home's home, as it were.
Listerdale maternity home, to be exact, as it was back then, some 50 years ago this month, actually. Just celebrated the big 5-0, or the Hawaii birthday, as I call it.
Oh, okay. All right. So, but the... have you lived anywhere else? Have you moved anywhere else, or have you always been in Rotherham?
I'm not going to be on the Yorkshire border, but from 2000 to 2013, I ran a number of pubs, and they were all based in Sheffield, so dual nationality almost. So I almost don't need my passport to cross the Rotherham-Sheffield border anymore.
Was it pubs? Because we had a conversation about earlier with somebody else we met this morning who was running a pub. Who was that?
Yes, Jim, that was at the networking event.
Oh, yeah, he's on another.
He's had a chain of pubs to his name. One or two common names came up actually this morning, who for legal purposes I'll not mention. And then also Robin, who I was speaking with this morning, bought a former pub about 20 years ago, and that's now the basis for his Platinum Interiors, I think he called it, his kitchen and bathroom business, and has 7 apartments above it. So he obviously saw the demise of the pub trade before it began demising.
Oh, right. Because, some statistic I was reading, is it 300 pubs a month are disappearing in the country? Does that sound right?
That wouldn't surprise me in the slightest, Martin, to be honest. Like
So why aren't pubs working? I mean, there's some... I've been to very successful pubs. What's the criteria for a good pub in the 21st century?
I think we've lost sight of what the public house actually was. And this came up, I think, in the last conversation. I mentioned that the public house, in its origins, was a place where I think it was usually the men could go that was more comfortable than their own homes. Mm-hmm. And it was only later that alcohol was introduced to them. Yeah, it was literally just a place where people could go and meet. I suspect that part of the problem is a lot of what we would call pubs are no longer pubs in the sense of the public house. They're places, very few seats, you stand up, you're supposed to drink loads and loads of lager, Yeah, and it's about just getting people to spend as much as possible and cramming as many in as you possibly can. And that sort of spoils that sense. And also our homes are a lot more comfortable than they used to be as well.
Is that hiding a social issue about drinking and stuff? Because I'm not a big drinker. I've never been drinking. I'm one of these people that gets depressed if I drink, so I kind of naturally stop. But there are other people, you know, who I need that. I don't know. And I don't find the pubs as a...
I'm a Methodist, and traditionally Methodism has been about being teetotal, although that ended, I think, around about the 1970s, and it's a lot more relaxed now. But one of the things I say when I occasionally encounter people who are sort of vehemently teetotal is that we should be looking not just at... I think putting restrictions on the sale of alcohol is probably counterproductive because people will always find it. But what we should be looking at is the social environment in which we do drink alcohol. And I think one of the big problems is that a lot of alcoholism is private, you know, people drinking at home on their own. if we could make it much more socially acceptable to meet together and drink together, that would be one way of putting more effective controls on alcohol. Because if you go to other countries, you know, drinking is always social.
Yeah, and it's not done in excess. I mean, Sheffield, really, you know, when you go out to the Friday night, you know, people spend all week just waiting to get bladdered on Friday night. Can we make it more sociable enterprise? I don't know.
I think Chris raised a couple of interesting points there. I mean, one of them is quite often the local pub is perceived as the cause of the noise nuisance, as disruption for little outing and one thing and another through the sale of alcohol. But as someone who still holds a personal license to this day, it's nice to be able to redress the balance, because the issue is that as someone who held a license for an on-license, I was very restricted by the times I could open and what kind of entertainment I could put on, what time music had to finish and that kind of thing. So I had to be very responsible, which someone that's in a situation that can sign passport applications and shotgun applications, you want a person that is responsible, whereas the supermarkets now are able to sell alcohol 24 hours a day. So if somebody wants to go and buy a litre of vodka to put it on their cornflakes or something in the morning, there's no restriction which stops them doing that. Whereas, as I said, as a holder of an on-licence, then I had a lot of restrictions upon me to make sure that I ran my businesses responsibly. And I think the other aspect we've touched on there is the sociable drinking, in that, as Chris quite rightly said, at one time it used to be the hub, the meeting place for a community. And when it got to a situation where you'd go to the pub and there'd only be you and your wife in there, then why would you go to a pub where, if you're a smoker, you had to go and smoke outside since the introduction of the smoking ban? The cost of skying pubs has got so prohibitive that very few of them have that. So you could go home and drink at supermarket prices in the comfort of your own home with a cigarette, should you be a smoker, and watch the television programme of your choice. And I really don't think that's helped with the continuation of the Great British Pub, which, for me, it's something I'm passionate about, and I think it's a real essential part of our heritage that is so far in demise now. I don't think we'll ever get it back.
We're all nodding in the van for the purpose of the radio. I mean, I kind of agree with that, but aren't we in this an era of redefining these things? Or do we go back to what a pub was originally intended, or do we look at it in a different way? I mean, I quite like to go out and socialise and everything else, but you know, the biggest thing I find in a pub these days is that I can't go somewhere and it's quiet. You know, it's a pub quiz or something, and they involve everybody and engaging everybody, or that sort of things, or open mic nights. Now, I play music, but somehow a pub. I struggle to find a pub in the in my local area where I can enjoy going to. So what is it? Is there a formula for the 21st century? I think what was just out of your own thing. What your experience is not better than mine. So what makes a successful pub now going forward as opposed to?
I know some people are going to smile at this, and other people are going to cringe at the thought of it. But the JD Weatherspoon model of stack it high, sell it cheap, is very successful for them. That's applying to both their drinks and their food as well. And they've made sure they've sort of gone down the route where there's the Weatherspoon aspect, where there's no live entertainment or background music or anything, and then to cater for the age group or the area of society that wants that aspect of things, then there's the Lloyd's Bar side of things where they cater for that as well. And for me personally now, as I said, I've recently turned 50 years of age. For me, I've been a real ale man for a long time, to be honest. Always a big fan of the cask ales, and I'm really pleased to see the rising of what's known as the micro pub, which is a very small pub, and quite often goes back to exactly what you're looking for in a pub, Martin, where because of the size of the pub, doesn't tend to have live bands or singing or Sky Sports or anything like that. In fact, quite a few of the micro pubs that are springing up now don't even serve lager. So it's great to see pubs where it's all about the good old-fashioned real ale, and then there may well be a choice of wines or soft drinks, and that's about it. There's a couple actually sprung up in my own hometown of Rotherham, and I know whenever I find myself with the opportunity to go and enjoy a little bit of sea air in Whitby, the old waiting room there has been converted to a micro pub, and it does very well with the people wanting to escape the whole lager lout culture and the noise of pubs for people that are looking for something more peaceful.
So these things are coming about because people's genuine sort of hobbies made into more like a small business.
Absolutely that, yes.
Yeah.
And I don't disagree with any of that. I'll just add to it that I am actually going to a pub tonight, and it's a pub that I've been going to for many years called the Fat Cat in Carmarthen. It's a quiet pub. It's always had at least one no smoking room, and now all of them are no smoking with the smoking ban. Brilliant food. It's got a no chips rule, but you can get roast potatoes, which are not the same thing as chips at all, apparently. Very reasonably priced, and home cooked food. And loads and loads of real ales. And the reason I'm going tonight is they have an upstairs room, and once a month they have storytelling. You know, something called Story Forge. So there will be a story. There's a brought in storyteller tonight. I can't remember her name or what she's. And she hasn't told anybody what she's going to tell the story about. But it'll be brilliant.
This is in addition to another storytelling thing.
Yeah. This is storytelling for entertainment. I do storytelling to help people with their marketing.
Yes.
Performance storytelling is another dimension to storytelling. What I try to do is to encourage business people to do performance as well as publish stories. But
coming back to the tonight, Fat Cat then.
Tonight so is entertainment.
It's like an open mic storytelling.
It's not always open. Tonight's not open mic. As I say, they've got a guest storyteller.
Right.
So she'll be, and I mean, they might have a few additional people, but it meets most months, and approximately alternate months they have an open mic.
Right. What's it called? what's the forum? What's the?
It's called Story Forge.
Story Forge.
Yes, as in Sheffield
Forge,
Sheffield
steel and proper things like that. Yeah. Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Yeah. That's at the Fat Cat.
Yeah, that's tonight. But they've got an upstairs room, so it doesn't interfere with the life of the pub downstairs.
No. I've been banned from the Fat Cat.
Have you?
Really?
How'd you manage that?
Tell us more, Martin.
Well, it was very, very simple, really, because friends of mine, they did the pub quiz thing there. And they were short one day, so I said, well, I'll come along. I brought a mate of mine, came along, joined in the thing, won the quiz. And then they said we hadn't registered our team properly, and therefore we weren't allowed for our... I think we got a barrel of beer or something, not a barrel.
A yard of ale.
A yard of ale, and those sort of, that sort of idea. And they said, yeah, you're not welcome back. And that was it. Because we hadn't followed the rules. So I think the official ban still, nobody's talking.
How long ago was that?
Oh, about 10 years ago, probably. Yeah.
I think the person who was in charge then has died.
Oh, has he?
I think so, yeah.
Oh, right.
So if you meet him, he's a ghost.
That's another way of saying it. Do you think my ban then is now... I can go back to the fact.
Well, I should imagine they'll have forgotten you.
Yes.
I would imagine that you looked younger 10 years ago.
Yes, I did a little bit. Yeah.
Yeah. 10 years younger.
But they objected to the fact that because we hadn't, it was got quite competitive. I mean, these people said, "Who are you and what are you doing and what sort of team?" And you know, they really didn't. They took exception to the fact that we came along. But that, in a funny way, it was actually quite entertaining. And you know, I'd quite happily go back and have some fun.
I think that brings to mind, actually, Martin, another aspect of how pubs aren't how they used to be. In that, I remember in my 13 years as pub landlord, quiz nights were always a really good, fun night. There was camaraderie, yet friendly banter and competition at the same time. And it used to be a matter of pride that if you won the quiz on a particular night, it meant you had better general knowledge of the subjects that happened to come up that night than anyone else in the pub. And then with technology progressing as it has, it got to the situation where it wasn't a case of who had the best general knowledge or who was the most knowledgeable, but who had the quickest thumbs on Google to be able to Google the answer to any question that you asked, which somewhat took the fun out of it and just made it a non-event, really. So I progressed from there to actually hosting free-to-enter through the ages music quizzes. And if any of your listeners remember back in the day, they'll remember that exact phrase. And for at least two-thirds of the marks, that was involving just playing a piece of music and asking for the artist and the year, which wasn't quite so easy to Google, because if you didn't know what the song was, you couldn't do that. So that served me for a while. And then, again, with technology, I think it was something called Soundhound or something like that, where people could just put the mobile phones up to the speaker the music was playing from. It would tell them the title of the track, the name of the artist, and the year it first charted.
It's called Shazam.
Shazam now, is it?
Shazam is the one. Yes, it is.
So that spoilt that as well.
Right, well, because I don't know about you, but when I listen to music, I don't listen to lyrics. So Shazam was a fantastic one for me, because I got a whole new world. I could really quick up, because I couldn't hear the lyrics. Yeah, I actually couldn't hear them. Yeah, some people, I don't know, they do seem to hear a song for once and then they're singing it, and I hear it once and I haven't heard of the words. I don't understand. So the Shazam as an app, being a technologist, was great fun, because I could then immediately get the lyrics and maybe get another aspect to it. So you're there. You are. There's one side of one. Your pub quiz is a trash because of it. And there's me getting, you know, a whole new environment or something interesting to, you know, to find out about the lyrics, which is great. So, oh, anyway. So there you are. So there's always a plus and a minus, I guess, on this.
Absolutely, couldn't agree more. Technology, social media, whatever, you know, they are pretty much neutral. It's just whether they're used for good or bad that makes the difference.
You just have to ask cleverer questions that you can't straightforward.
Well, I think doesn't that make it more of a challenge?
It's more about pattern recognition, puzzles.
Yeah.
In fact, I keep thinking of some questions to you. Because we have a quiz most weeks at Destination Depot.
Oh yes, they're getting a bit.
I don't think people use their mobile phones for that one, but I'm building a list of complicated puzzle questions that probably no one will be able to answer.
Well, that might put people off a bit.
Yes, it might.
The one I listen to and I wake up to is Radio 4, and they've got this thing. You know, you come across these things where they do maths problems. Challenge people to come up.
There's a puzzle. Before 7 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, you get it when you're getting ready to leave house for destination.
Yes, you do. Well, this morning I was listening to it, but they're getting a bit tired in their format. And you never hear the answers. I've never heard an answer to the quiz. They never say, next day the answer was 652 or something.
Yes, I wonder where they drew the answers.
Well, you see, there you are. So what happens to these? This just fills in 2 minutes of the today programme schedule. It doesn't appear to have a purpose. Now, you would question that, and I think that expands out into all sorts of things. You know, these things like, coming back to our networking things, do they have a purpose, or what is the purpose, or is it the same purpose for everybody? And I don't think it is. People come here for all different reasons, and to try and be prescriptive is possibly the wrong way of doing it and allowing things to happen. And the kind of where this podcasting things and things are happening is it generates stuff that you can't plan. It's not predictable. And I find it quite much from a business point of view, it brings up all sorts of possibilities that you wouldn't sit down and try and engineer. It just gives a bit more freedom for people to come up with some ideas. And maybe we're in the part of time of the world. I was literally banging the desk last night, listening to the excuses Boris Johnson had for not talking to the Luxembourg premier, and it was like going back to the school yard, you know, some sort of, you know, I'm not talking to you because I don't like you, or, you know, it was pathetic. And yet these are the people, you know, we're supposed to be making decisions for us. Yeah. So I'm going to lob this one in as the last thing, because we're going to before time gets on, but isn't it up to us now to determine where this country's going, as opposed to our putting it in, trusting our politicians to do it?
Yeah. I mean, I find it amazing, and I have done for the whole of this period since the referendum, of how poor at negotiating the British government is. They don't know the first thing about it. Yeah, and if you've got a negotiation strategy, you don't tell everybody on the media what it is, because the Europeans are listening in. And they're forever telling us, we're going in and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. That's not how you negotiate. Yeah. You keep your powder dry.
I was listening, you know, Cameron has been on this week flogging his book. Mm-hmm. And I think it's been slated from every angle.
It sounds brilliant, doesn't it?
Well, yeah. he'd probably sell more books on the back of it, but whether you, I don't know, it just seems to be incredible that an individual's sort of the way, you know, I can't even think what it is, you know, his view on life created this chaos, and he seemed oblivious to the consequences and so on. And there we are, well, I know, sort of thing. But I was coming back to think, I think there's a massive amount of enterprise and lots of exciting things happening, and that it's almost going back to, you know, like reinventing the country, and, you know, where's it going to go from here, type thing?
Yeah, I have to say I'm not the ideal person to comment on current affairs, as I find there's so much doom and gloom in the news at the moment. As a disabled person myself, I tend to get all my current affairs information from the Last Leg programme, where if you're a member of the club, it's okay for disabled people to make light of other disabled people. And given that the Last Leg show is currently taking its summer break at the moment, I'm a little bit of an ostrich at the moment. I'm a little bit out of touch with what's going on in current affairs. I have to say, though, as someone who spent 3.5 months in hospital, I have a lot of empathy now with the NHS staff who are on the front line, having to deal with decisions made by politicians as a victim of crime, which is what led to me being in the hospital for that 3.5 months. I can actually see the consequences of our police forces being so reduced from what they were. And as someone who, as a result of that, has now gone on to speak in schools, again, I have so much empathy with our teachers, seeing what they're having to do and seeing, you know, when they say you can't make an omelette without breaking eggs, they're doing an amazing job with what almost seems like both hands tied behind the back at the moment.
Right. But you just said something there, which is, I don't know, did you actually mean that? Instead, are you saying that if you're not disabled, you can't criticise disabled people? Or do you take, or do people, this, if any disability, can you, are there boundaries to what you can talk about if you're not disabled and disabled?
That's a great question, Martin. I personally, as a disabled person, want to be treated the same as everyone else. So when I give my keynote stage speeches, one of the first things I refer to is being disabled and say, oh, that's the elephant out of the room, and make light of it at that point. There seems to be a societal norm of a belief that if you're not disabled, then you're then it's politically incorrect to make fun of someone who is, as in with people from ethnic minorities, it's very much the case now where comedians of that background will do that, whereas the rest of society won't, because of the perception of it.
I know lots of people that you know who are disabled and such, but I make light of it, I think. And sometimes I might be offensive in a sense, you know, people will know, you forget that, you know, you can just do something and then they can't do it. But it's not done out of sort of, you know, ignorance particularly. It's just that you want to be part of what it is, and every now and again, maybe you might offend somebody, and equally it works the other way around, you know. It's just as a normal conversation. Yeah, you know, some people might be offended by what you say and so on, you know, but that's not because you're disabled or not. But it's interesting that something like I'm big into sports, for example, so got Paralympics and Olympics, you know, and yep. You know, arguably this world, you know, the Olympics is a bigger event, but the Paralympians want to be on par, for example, in terms of appeal and, you know, and audience and sponsorship and all these sort of things. And I'm not so sure, are they comparable, or why should they be comparable? You know, there's, you know, if you're wanting to be a Paralympian, you are a Paralympian, you're not an Olympic. Is that, you know, do you see what I mean?
Yeah, I can see where you're coming from with that. And I don't think there needs to be an element of a level playing field, staying right with the sports analogy there. So
yeah,
I think there definitely needs to be a difference if you've got someone that's a Paralympian as opposed to an able-bodied Olympian.
Yeah.
Because obviously they do have challenges.
Yeah.
But for those of us with disabilities, we don't really want it to be the elephant in the room. And also, when there are aspects where we can do what someone else can do. Mm. And even this morning, I had to ask someone to carry me a hot drink over to the table. And they said, I really wanted to offer, but I didn't know whether you'd be offended if I did offer. Well, so yeah. I thought I'd wait while you asked. So there's a lot of that within society going on. And it's all done with the best of intent.
Yes, but I think that when you get to the point where you're afraid to interact on the basis of, you know, you're everybody's equal type thing, you know, but, you know, I can't do it.
No, I think I heard something, this sort of conversation on the radio recently, and as far as I can remember from the conversation, the verdict was, if you're not sure, ask the disabled person, can I help you? What you don't do is grab hold of them and drag them across the road. Or but that's quite a common experience, particularly yes. for people who are blind. You know, someone will suddenly grab them. Of course, that's absolutely terrifying because you don't know who it is, and but usually they're trying to help, and but then they don't say, "Do you need any help?" Because you know, because if they ask, then all the blind person needs to do is put their hand out and just, you know,
just gesture that they would.
Well, just to, touch them so they know, and you know, and then they can move with them.
Oh, right.
But people don't, they don't really appreciate what it's about, and it's the same, you know. You just ask Roger whether he wants you, whether he'd like you to fetch him a drink.
I don't know. I err on the side that it doesn't really matter, and you just to treat everybody as a normal, courteous human being, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
Absolutely.
And you don't care whether you can or cannot. You know, if I say you fancy, you know, I'll probably pick up a cup of coffee for an able-bodied person as a wounded and disabled, just on the basis we get, you know, carry it, an offer. And I think that's what we're kind of saying, isn't it? You just sort of kind of, people don't, it's not an issue. You say the elephant in the room type thing, but I think, you know, it minimises. I don't see it like that, which is, you know, people, I think, appreciate it. We just treat them like normal. You know?
Absolutely, we do, yes.
Yeah.
So not that I can speak for every disabled person, but personally.
But they're all individual at the same time, so you don't have to like anybody, you know, whether disabled or not. So I'm getting it. So it's a human interaction idea. Anyway, I'm going to we've gone up to 30 minutes already, as usual. It goes on forever.
The time's so flown, Martin.
The time flies, we were putting this. We're going to do just. I'm going to put it on record here. We're going to publish these on a weekly basis on a Friday, so that people know this as an idea when they're coming out. So Roger was asking when this is going to go out. This is Tuesday today, so it'll be out on Friday, and we're going to publish that as part of the platform, become a regular thing. And I took that cue from the Radio 4, despite the fact that, you know, it has no purpose at all, but at a 10 to 8 or a 10 to 7 it is, there's always the same thing. So it's interesting, you know, maybe just familiarity, and then people get to understand it. Anyway, great.
And as a big advocate of accountability, congratulations to you for going on air, Martin, and making that commitment.
Good, thank you very much. Good, so we'll stop.